This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In November of 2014, we lost another major American poet. Mark Strand died at the age of 80. He was a U.S. Poet Laureate from 1990 to 1991. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1999 for his collection of poems, Blizzard of One. One of the reasons that I started this radio program so many years ago now is that I like to hear poets read their work themselves. I want to hear their own voices, and I'd like to share that with you. So I'm going to start out the program tonight with a recording of Mark Strand reading his poem Black Sea. And then I'm going to read his poem Eating Poetry. It's a fun poem, one of my favorites. Following the short segment on Mark Strand, I'm going to go ahead and play our traditional Dylan Thomas recording of A Child's Christmas in Wales, and then we'll move on to other things. But first, here is Mark Strand.
I am Mark Strand, and I am reading Black Sea from my forthcoming book, Man and Camel. One clear night, while the others slept, I climbed the stairs to the roof of the house, and under a sky strewn with stars I gazed at the sea, at the spread of it, the rolling crests of it raked by the wind, becoming like bits of lace tossed in the air. I stood in the long whispering night waiting for something, a sign, the approach of a distant light, and I imagined you coming closer, the dark waves of your hair mingling with the sea, and the dark became desire, and desire the arriving light. The nearness, the momentary warmth of you, as I stood on that lonely height, watching the slow swells of the sea break on the shore and turn briefly into glass and disappear. Why did I believe you would come out of nowhere? Why, with all that the world offers, would you come only because I was here?
Eating poetry. Ink runs from the corners of my mouth. There is no happiness like mine. I have been eating poetry. The librarian does not believe what she sees. Her eyes are sad, and she walks with her hands in her dress. The poems are gone. The light is dim. The dogs are on the basement stairs and coming up. Their eyeballs roll. Their blonde legs burn like brush. The poor librarian begins to stamp her feet and weep. She does not understand. When I get on my knees and lick her hand, she screams. I am a new man. I snarl at her and bark. I romp with joy in the bookish dark. That was a poem by Mark Strand called Eating Poetry. And now, like I do every year at this time, I'm going to play a recording of the great Dylan Thomas reading his short story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. Enjoy.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stopped at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea. and out come Mrs. Protheroe and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Protheroe's garden, waiting for cats with her son, Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, is white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold, and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Protheroe's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. "Fire!" cried Mrs. Protheroe, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms towards the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombolating, and Mrs. Protheroe was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house laden with snowballs and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Protheroe, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Protheroe as she beat the gong. "They won't be here," said Mr. Protheroe. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Protheroe standing in the middle of them, waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Protheroe, and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance. And Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade. And soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Protheroe got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the firemen turned off the hose and were standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Miss Protheroe, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing, always. She looked at the three tall firemen in their shining helmets, standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said, "Would you like anything to read?" Years and years ago, when I was a boy, when there were wolves in Wales, and birds the color of red flannel petticoats whisked past the harp-shaped hills, when we sang and wallowed all night and day in caves that smelt like Sunday afternoons in damp front farmhouse parlors, and we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears. Before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback, it snowed and it snowed. But here a small boy says, "It snowed last year, too. I made a snowman and my brother knocked it down, and I knocked my brother down, and then we had tea." But that was not the same snow, I say. Our snow was not only shaken from whitewashed buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms and hands and bodies of the trees. Snow grew overnight on the roofs of the houses like a pure and grandfather moss. Minutely ivied the walls and settled on the postman opening the gate like a dumb, numb thunderstorm of white, torn Christmas cards. Were there postmen then, too? with sprinkling eyes and wind-cherried noses, on spread frozen feet, they crunched up to the doors and mittened on them manfully. But all that the children could hear was a ringing of bells. You mean that the postman went rat-a-tat-tat and the doors rang? I mean that the bells that the children could hear were inside them. I only hear thunder sometimes, never bells. There were church bells, too. Inside them? No, 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 in the bat-black, snow-white belfries tugged by bishops and storks. And they rang their tidings over the bandaged town, over the frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills, over the crackling sea. It seemed that all the churches boomed for joy under my window, and the weathercocks crew for Christmas on our fence. Get back to the postman. They were just ordinary postmen, fond of walking and dogs and Christmas and the snow. They knocked on the doors with blue knuckles. Ours has got a black knocker. And then they stood on the white welcome mat in the little drifted porches and huffed and puffed, making ghosts with their breath, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the present. And then the presents after the Christmas box. And the cold postman with a rose on his button nose tingled down the tea-tray slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-boned boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs. He wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the present. There were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days and mittens made for giant sloths, zebra scarves of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes, blinding tam-o'-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tripes. From aunts who always wore wool next to the skin, there were moustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nose bag from an aunt now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose and a tram conductor's cap and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet. And a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound, a mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow. And a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I pleased. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled toffee, fudge and all sorts, crunches, cracknel, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh. And troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run. And snakes and families and happy ladders and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick, to shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth, and you stood at the corner of the street, and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then with a smirk you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons. Were there uncles like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swathed town for the news of the little world and find always a dead bird by the post office or the white deserted swings. Perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women wading, scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-busked cheeks, all albinos, huddled their stiff black jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnuts and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons. And cats in their furabouts watched the fires, and the high-heaped fires spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small aunts, not wanted in the kitchen, nor anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break like faded cups and saucers. Not many those mornings trod the piling streets. An old man, always fawn-bowlered, yellow-gloved, and at this time of year with spats of snow, would take his constitutional to the white bowling green and back as he would take it wet or fire or on Christmas Day or Doomsday. Sometimes two hale young men with big pipes blazing, no overcoats and wind-blown scarves, would trudge unspeaking down to the forlorn sea to work up an appetite to blow away the fumes, who knows, to walk into the waves until nothing of them was left but the two curling smoke clouds of their inextinguishable briars. Then I would be slapdashing home, the gravy smell of the dinners of others, the bird smell, the brandy, the pudding and mince coiling up to my nostrils, when out of a snow-clogged side lane would come a boy, the spit of myself, with a pink-tipped cigarette and the violet past of a black eye, cocky as a bullfinch, leering all to himself. I hated him on sight and sound, and would be about to put my dog whistle to my lips and blow him off the face of Christmas, when suddenly he, with a violet wink, put his whistle to his lips and blew so stridently, so high, so exquisitely loud, that gobbling faces, their cheek bulged with goose, would press against their tinseled windows the whole length of the white echoing street. For dinner we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro bearing tureens. Aunt Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dursey had to have three aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard, singing like a big-bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and then when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-o-war, following the instructions for little engineers, and produce what might be mistaken for a sea-going tramcar. Or I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking into the white world onto the seaward hill, to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think they've been hippos. What did you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this, bang! I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw two hippos? Iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos clanked and battered through the scudding snow towards us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house. Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn. Or we walked on the white shore. Can the fishes see it snowing? The silent, one-clouded heavens drifted onto the sea. Now we were snowblind travelers lost on the North Hills, and vast dewlapped dogs with flasks round their necks ambled and shambled up to us, baying excelsior. We returned home through the poor streets, where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow and kept called after us, their voices fading away as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum, because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts wooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once, when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house, and we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand, in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas. I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry, eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle, gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said. And we did that. Always on Christmas night, there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's Drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got onto the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest. And then everybody laughed again, and then I went to bed. Looking through my bedroom window, out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill, and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept.
And just in case you just stepped in, you've been listening to Dylan Thomas reading his short story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. I'm going to move on to our musical segment right now, and I'm not going to play any Christmas music. This is Pink Martini performing La Soledad. And following the music, I'm going to play an interview from a few years ago that I had with Giovanni Singleton, a very fine poet. Here we go, first with Pink Martini and La Soledad.
Thank you. En la canción, mostrándome un nuevo mundo de pasión, amándome sin egoísmo y la razón, no más sin saber que era el amor. Yo protegí mi corazón, el sol se fue. Y yo cantando tu canción, la soledad se adueña de toda emoción. Perdóname si el miedo robó la ilusión. No viniste a mí, no supe amar y solo queda esta canción. Poesía en la canción, mostrándome un nuevo mundo de pasión, amándome sin egoísmo y la razón.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Giovanni Singleton, lowercase g, lowercase s. She is the author of Ascension, released in 2012 by Counterpath Press, and it was nominated for a California Book Award, which is pretty cool. We're going to talk about the book and hear some poems in just a minute, but first, Giovanni Singleton, let's talk about you. I'm going to start by reading the bio that appears in the book, and then maybe you can fill us in on a little more. Giovanni Singleton is a poet, teacher, and founding editor of Nocturnes, Review of the Literary Arts, a journal dedicated to the work of artists and writers of the African diaspora and other contested spaces. A recipient of a new Langton Bay Area Award Show for Literature, she frequently presents on writing, editing, and graphic design at schools and conferences, including the American Literature Association and Spelman College. She has been a fellow at the Squaw Valley Community of Writers, Kaveh Kanem, and the Napa Valley Writers Conference. Her work has appeared on the building of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts and in Zen Monster, Volt, Hallelu, Poet Lore, Angles of Ascent, a Norton anthology, What I Say, Innovative Poetry by Black Writers in America, Kindergarten, Avant-Garde Poems, Plays and Stories for Children, and I'll Drown My Book, a collection of conceptual writing. Ooh, that's a lot of work. Singleton has taught at St. Mary's College, Naropa University, and in museums and schools throughout the San Francisco Bay Area. Welcome, Giovanni.
Thank you.
You've done a lot, from the San Francisco Bay Area to Atlanta to Colorado and back again. Where are you from?
I was born and raised in Richmond, Virginia, and went to undergraduate school in Washington, D.C., where I majored in print journalism. And then I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area about 20 years ago for graduate school.
Where did you go to school?
I attended the New College of California in San Francisco, and I received my MFA.
Oh, great. So did you study with David Meltzer and Neely Tchaikovsky? Who did you study with there?
I studied with David Meltzer. He actually was how I got through graduate school, along with the poets Gloria Frim and Lynn Hajinian.
So although your poetry has appeared in about a gazillion places, Ascension, I think, is your first full-length collection of poetry. Is that right?
That's correct. It is my first.
You were raised in Virginia. When did you start writing, and did growing up there influence your writing in any way?
I started writing before I actually knew how to write, actually. From an early age, I remember holding pens and crayons and markers, all manner of writing implements. And I enjoyed playing with those more than with toys. And even before I knew the alphabet, making a mark, any mark, gave me a profound sense of freedom, which I don't really think that my surroundings gave me, particularly historically, you know, as the former capital of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in connecting to a sense of freedom from making all kinds of marks. And it helped me to understand that writing in that way requires a certain amount of courage, actually.
Turning to the book, one of the first things I have to mention is the cover. It is one of the most gorgeous covers of a book of poetry I've ever seen. How did you find that image? And it's The Cowrie Necklace by Albert Chong.
I first encountered the work of Albert Chong in 2004, I believe, at in a group show at the San Jose Museum of Art. At the time, I was editing a literary magazine, Nocturne's Review of the Literary Arts, and was always on the lookout for amazing visual art to use for the cover and also to include in the interior. And I encountered the cover image at Albert's website as I continued to follow his work since that time. And I actually had in mind to use it as a cover for an issue of the magazine. But upon completing my book, I returned to the image. No, I want the image for myself in a way. And actually, it's a collage, but it's a part of a larger work that's actually entitled Ascension.
Well, you have several nice, what we call blurbs in the industry, on the back of the book. The one offered by Ed Roberson says that the majority of poems in the book were written during Alice Coltrane's 49-day transition through the bardo. So there are a couple of things to talk about here. First, Alice Coltrane, who was married to the jazz musician John Coltrane, but was really a fine musician herself, as well as a woman of a chosen spiritual path. I wonder if you would talk for a minute about why Alice Coltrane, and define for our listeners the use of the term bardo here, which I understand to be a transitional state.
So I encountered Alice Coltrane's music one day at a neighborhood record shop. I was living in the Mission, and I saw a CD of hers entitled Journey in Satchidananda. And just seeing her on the cover of a CD, I felt very, very drawn to her and figured she had something to say. I was also intrigued by the fact that she actually was a jazz instrumentalist. Many women in jazz tend to be vocalists. So I thought maybe she looked like she had something to say. So I bought the CD, I took it home, and it was still playing when I was back at the record store looking for more music by her. I was really attracted by her connection between art and spirit and her spiritual practice. She was a spiritual leader and had a community, a Vedantic community in Southern California. So this was right after finishing graduate school, and I was sort of adrift. So I decided to go on a quest to meet Alice Coltrane, to find Alice Coltrane, only to discover that she had retired from public performance. So I continued to collect her albums because most of her music was out of print. It was not available on CD, with the exception of the two that I had. And so I continued listening and studying and trying to find out more about her until about 2006, when she came out of retirement. She ended her 25-year absence, and I was able to see her in concert in first at UCLA in February 2006. And then I attended her last concert in San Francisco in November 2006. I also visited her ashram. And the day that I was there, she was unable to, she had laryngitis, so she wasn't able to give a discourse. So she played the Wurlitzer organ in this tiny temple for about an hour nonstop. Oh. It was incredible, quite transcendent. So when she died in 2007, January 2007, I was really sort of crushed. And I also discovered that she had a connection with one of my poetry mentors, Lucille Clifton. Mm-hmm. They were quite close, and their kids dated. And so I was really sad. I did go to the ashram for her crossing over ceremony, but that wasn't enough. At that point, I had stopped writing, actually, for about 10 years. I had not been writing. So I took her death as an opportunity to see where I could re-enter that path, like actually find my own voice. And so for 49 days, which is the time Tibetan Buddhists believe that it takes for one to transition between a present life and the next life, I decided to sort of maintain a daily writing practice. And so that forms the basis of it.
One section of the book is written as if it's a musical suite. That's Melanin Suite, and each poem has a different shade of brown, burnt umber, sienna, etc. Tell me about that section of the book. It's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think for me that section was came about mainly in homage to the sort of palette that Alice Coltrane's music brought up for me, and looking at how one could explore identity as an African-American woman through music and through the relationships of words. So seeing words as sort of notes was how I sort of approached that section. It's like, you know, what would it sound like? You know, how could color have texture?
One of the most powerful aspects of the poems in the book might be described as nothingness. There is so much white space. The language is so spare, so quiet, and yet the end result is something that is extremely powerful, I think, in its intent. The portion of the book called Day 23 consists of just one line. Too much pruning brings misfortune. There is no misfortune in your work. Has this always been your writing style, or did you put this into practice especially for Ascension?
I think I put it into practice especially for Ascension. I've studied quite a lot the objectivist poets who used very spare language, as well as Japanese and other Asian poetries also influenced me. Is I want to see what is possible in the smallest word units and the smallest amount of words.
The final section is IEYE of the Beholder. And it's a serious little section, and it's very playful all at the same time. It is a disappearing letter I. The first page has uppercase I. That is it. The following page has lowercase I. That is it. The following page has the dot for the I. That's all. And then there's a blank page. Talk to me, Giovanni.
Well, I think that poem was my attempt to come to terms with the preoccupation of meditation, which is the dissolution of the I, of the ego. And so I thought I would render it visually and see what that would feel like and what it would it sound like and what the end result would be. And it's like, okay, you know, going back into the void from which we all come.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's really great. So let's actually open the book now and let our listeners hear you read firsthand what we've been talking about. This is Giovanni Singleton, and she is reading from her new book, Ascension.
January 13th, 2007, Day 2. Blues poet stands at the crossroads, framed in indigo light. He reaches his hand around to his left side, slits himself open as if to gut a fish. Once inside, he feels his heart, touches his liver. But he is not an oyster. He has not eaten sand. What then can a pearl be? January 17th, Day 6. First person narrative. I am not for sale at any price. End of story. January 18th, Day 7. And just what color is blue? Names forgive their meaning. Sundays are for what a mind thinks. History of touching stretches out beneath the surface. The only way to sleep is to imagine it is raining. And it is raining. Wind blows open and over a final line of defense. What happens, happens far away. January 23rd, Day 12. Dead fox beside the road. The risk we all run. January 29th, Day 18. Because he disremembered the past bound itself to him. It creased his mouth, furrowed his brow, grayed his hair. When he spoke, his voice used the language of disremembering. Because he disremembered his ex-wife, their love bound itself to him. Whenever he turned around, one could see her face looking out from the back of his head. February 1st, Day 21. She went up the main road a ways. She did, she did. A button fell from her one good dress. Sweat rolled slowly down her brow. It did, it did. She looked and looked all around. She did, she did. But she never came back. February 7th, Day 27. All that day, labored breath, the dead brushed against me. A litany of faces, their names beside. Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Toni K. Bambara, Mahalia Jackson, Shirley Ann Hempel, Isabel Sanford, Shirley Chisholm, Clara Ward, Nell Carter, Lynn Thigpen, Fantastic Gyre, Hours Struck, Memory Turned Upon Itself, Unable to Halt, Liberation, The Souls, Cast Iron, Clapper. February 15th, Day 35. When I was 9 years old, I killed a bird, he said. Why? I asked. Because I wanted to see what was inside. And did you see? I don't remember. Well, then close your eyes. Why? He asked. To see what's inside, I said. February 16th, Day 36. We are busy in wanting to push through light. The bowl I drink from says we humans keep cutting back the trees so that we alone can live. And I realize, too, just how much I don't want to be lost. February 19th, day 39. Black girl, you a black girl. Black girl, play on blacktop, play. Girl, black, you a black girl. Jump down, turn around. Black girl, sing pretty song. You a black girl. Play on, merry-go-round, you. Black girl, look, merry-go-mad, you. Black, you, girl. February 22nd, day 42. In a fitful state, a neighbor swallowed the moon. People often wish to receive more than they give, pronounced the doctor, who weeks earlier had devoured three planets. February 27th, day 47. Brown bark stems picked for pretty, bent forward bodies, tufts of white, floral arranged in 12-foot window, not meant to frame, now absent master, save the boll weevil in turns of earth, the unmercied blink, cotton ball eyes, their mournful songs, my own pricked fingers. March 1st, day 49. Go, go, go into the forest, walk among the deer. Two selections from Melanin Sweet. We, us and thou, voices sound a downtown destination. The boulevard, horns blow, fast and furious. Ghostly drummer makes flight. Some rap, tap, 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 conductor of multi-directional speaking. Crowds stand behind cranial walls, all smoke-filled. Boy, man, a vast expanse. Skeletal remains spread down on the ground as in quilted covering. Eighth movement, Mahogany. Ecstatic song, escuchar, a mask in every note. Feather-fletched arrows due east, las palabras, a ceremonial gesture. Premonitions at the landscape's edge, palatial bed of wildflowers. Los ojos, an arc of rainbow light, la puerta, ears opening, a refrain as in Holy Ghost. And the last is a poem entitled Exodus. For the blue people, being so. All night about above, I go down, stare out at rushing water through open window. Ocean of starlit sky fills my head, unburdens the weight of my brain. Blooms a lotus flower, its stem stretches up through the soles of my feet. Pathway to the country inside me, its people seekers, naked in the smokeless clearing. Stained glass maze, past lifetimes spent hunting crow. Here they go, here they go, here they go. Astral stream of inky wings fluttering skyward. Echoes of ancient chants rise from the wooden cage in my throat. We are not this dance, but that one. Weather flashes across the backsides of my eyelids. We, me, and T-Monk too, hold up our chairs, go inside our cranial houses. This earth and soul, a flock of birds, where we are new, we are new, we are new to this body.
Giovanni, thank you so much for reading from Ascension. To hear you read it and to sometimes sing is a whole nother experience. Are you a musician yourself?
I would not say that, but I did and do play the clarinet, I admit.
Okay. It's hard to imagine you not writing over a span of 10 years, and I'm so glad that you have found your pen again. Why didn't you write for 10 full years?
Well, I started a meditation practice, and I really wanted to find out what I was made out of. As an individual, I think you bring yourself to your work. And, you know, to know the self is to forget the self. So I really had to find out and do some self, I felt self exploration. At least it turned out that way. I can say that in retrospect. But probably then I was caught up in survival mode of working, of trying to make a living, of trying to make sense of the world as a normal person.
whatever that is.
Whatever that is, exactly, yes.
What are you working on now?
I am working now on a series of poems which has to do with how one's relationship to one's environment. So it's a series called Reflected, and it's a collection of poems, the titles of which are either self-portrait or still life. So things that move are still lives, and things that are inanimate are called self-portraits.
Thank you so much again for reading, Giovanni.
And thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
You've been listening to an interview with the poet Giovanni Singleton. This interview took place a little over a couple of years ago when her first book of poems, Ascension, was released. Before we sign off tonight, I want to bring to your attention a couple of poetry events that will be happening in the county in January. January 2015, who knew? On Thursday, January 15th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Cloverdale Performing Arts Center, Books on Stage returns with poet Russ Messing, who is the author of A Convergence of Unanticipated Consequences, along with short story writer and memoir writer Laura McHale Holland. She is the editor of Sisters Born, Sisters Found, a diversity of voices on sisterhood, and the author of The Ice Cream Vendor Song and Reversible Skirt. This is a free event, again, Thursday, January 15th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Cloverdale Performing Arts Center. This is a series curated by the poet Michelle Wing, and if you haven't attended Books on Stage, do yourselves a favor and take the short drive up to Cloverdale. The Performing Arts Center is just a beautiful venue, and it's always a nice evening. And of course, I want to bring your attention to the Word Temple Poetry Series that will be returning in January. On Saturday, January 24th, 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, as usual, the two featured poets, or actually more than two featured poets, Ellery Akers is one of the featured poets. She is celebrating her latest collection called Practicing the Truth. This book won the 2014 Autumn House Poetry Prize, which was judged by none other than Alicia Ostricker. Talk about credentials. So this will be a fine reading. Akers' collection, Knocking on the Earth, was named a best book of the year by the San Jose Mercury News when that book came out. She is also the winner of 11 National Writing Awards and is the author of a children's novel called Sarah's Waterfall. Among her honors, Ellery Akers has fellowships from the McDowell Colony, UCross Foundation, and Headlands Center for the Arts. Joining Ellery Akers that night will be a good number of poets reading from the anthology Changing Harm to Harmony, Bullies and Bystanders Project. This anthology was put together by Marin County's Poet Laureate Joe Zicardi. He's just done a tremendous job with this. It's a book of poems, letters, and other writings that serve as a present-day response for changing harm to harmony, quote, best defined by the process of restorative justice. There are a number of contributors in the anthology who will read that night at Word Temple. The book includes poems by many San Francisco Bay Area poets, including many Sonoma County poets, as well as Mark Doty, Jane Mead, and Jane Hirschfield. Sample poem titles include Fat Kid by Peter Schmidt, The Invisible Boy by Paul Sohar, Such a Pretty Face by C.B. Follett, and Perfect Target by Rebecca Faust. So come support your local poets. They will be coming from San Francisco, the East Bay, Marin County, and, of course, many from right here in Sonoma County. It is a heartfelt and beautifully produced anthology, and Joe Zuccardi will be there himself to introduce the book. So again, that is Ellery Akers and Changing Harm to Harmony, Bullies and Bystanders Project at the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, January 24th at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. Okay, we have just a few more minutes here before sign-off time, so here are a few more poems to end the evening. Or maybe just one more poem. I am in the mood to hear My Papa's Waltz, read by the poet himself, the great Theodore Rettke. Here he is.
My Papa's Waltz. The whiskey on your breath could make a small boy dizzy. But I hung on like death. Such waltzing was not easy. We romped until the pans slid from the kitchen shelf. My mother's countenance could not unfrown itself. The hand that held my wrist was battered on one knuckle. At every step you missed, my right ear scraped a buckle. You beat time on my head with a palm caked hard by dirt, then waltzed me off to bed, still clinging to your shirt.
Okay, it's too early for most of us to waltz off to bed, but we have to waltz off the show now. Tonight's program featured Mark Strand, Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales, Giovanni Singleton with an interview from a couple of years ago, and of course we just closed out with a poem by Theodore Rettke. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, please get in touch with me at khastings@wordtemple.com. I always love hearing from you. And have a wonderful holiday season, and I'll see you back here in January and hopefully at the Word Temple Poetry Series live. For more information, you can go to www.wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.